This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Welcome to the world of Forbes, Barron's, and Fortune magazines. This is brought to you by the good folks at Mind's Eye Organization. My name is Greg Conroy. So let's get down to business. So this week, we're going to start out with Kiplinger's because of temporary unavailability issues with Forbes. Here's the cover story. Stretch the 2026 Social Security COLA, which stands for Cost of Living Adjustment. The 2.8% increase in payments may not seem like much, but these steps will help your benefits go further. By Beth Braverman. Counting on your annual inflation, quote-unquote, raise in Social Security benefits to help cover your rising expenses in 2026, you may find yourself frustrated as the new year unfolds. Social Security's annual cost of living adjustment will be 2.8% in 2026, just a smidge higher than 2025's 2.5% increase, which was the lowest boost in benefits since 2021. The average monthly payment will rise by about $56 to an estimated $2,071, while the maximum that a recipient can take home at full retirement age is expected to hit $4,152 a month, up from $4,018 in 2025. The modest COLA is a positive sign that inflation, despite creeping up lately due partly to tariffs, still remains far below recent pandemic-era highs. That good news may feel underwhelming, however, when you're at the checkout counter or paying your bills. Consumer prices have risen nearly 25% overall since 2020, and household staples such as eggs and beef have more than doubled in that period. Adding to the sting for 2026, an expected 11.6% increase in Medicare premiums, which will raise monthly payments for coverage by $21.54 for the typical beneficiary, wiping out nearly 40% of the increase in Social Security benefits. And if you're among the 5 million high-income Medicare recipients, you pay a premium surcharge known as the Income-Related Monthly Adjustment Amount, IRMAA, your Social Security payments could actually go down next year after factoring in the Medicare price hike. Retirees are feeling the pain. More than three-fourths of the respondents in a recent AARP poll said that a 3% COLA would not be enough to meet up with rising prices, while 72% said they'd need an adjustment of 5% or more to afford their living expenses. Quote, the loss of buying power for older Americans has really accumulated over the years, close quote, says Shannon Benton, executive director of the Senior Citizens League. Part of the problem, Benton notes, is that the Social Security Administration calculates the COLA using an inflation measure that reflects the expenses of urban wage earners rather than those of retirees. For example, she says, healthcare doesn't get enough weight, while technology costs, which may have less relevance for retirees, have an outsized impact. Quote, every year that the COLA doesn't keep up with the actual inflation rate that older people experience, it increases the loss of buying power more and more, close quote, Benton says. If the 2026 COLA won't keep up with your household's rising costs, these steps may help. Get creative about trimming costs. You may be able to lower your bills by asking and shopping around for better rates on everything from your gym membership to your insurance policies. More than 90% of Americans who switch auto insurance carriers save money, the majority by $100 or more a year, according to a recent LendingTree survey. The online loan marketplace has also found that 95% of credit card holders who ask to have an annual fee waived or reduced are successful. One in five baby boomers have a side hustle, earning $900 or more a month on average. Another prime place to look for savings, quote, subscriptions and service fees only go up, close quote, says Pam Kruger, founder and CEO of WealthTramp, a referral service for fiduciary financial advisors. Quote, think monthly streaming, extra cell lines, and lots of apps you probably don't use. Review them, then cancel the subscriptions you really don't need, close quote. If you have credit card debt, as do 42% of Americans aged 65 to 74, and 35% of those 75 and up, consider moving it to a balance transfer card with a 0% introductory rate to give you a break on interest charges while you pay it down. The introductory rate lasts for 15 months on average. Quote, credit card debt is something you should address head on, close quote, says Pedro Silva, principal partner at Apex Investment Group. Generate extra income. After diligently building your retirement savings for decades, it can be psychologically difficult to switch to spending mode, but a modest bump in withdrawals could provide you with just enough extra cash to cover higher expenses. More than one-fourth of retirees take less than 3% from portfolios every year, according to IRA Logix, even though studies suggest a 4% to 4.7% withdrawal rate, adjusted annually for inflation, will not put most retirees at risk of outliving their assets. Another option is to take on a part-time job or side hustle, something that one in five baby boomers now do, earning them an average of more than $900 per month, according to Bankrate. Sites such as SideHustle.com and RetirementJobs.com can help you find an opportunity that makes sense for your situation. Factor inflation into your investment plan. With tariffs projected to keep upward pressures on prices for the foreseeable future, retirees probably can't expect the challenge of what feels like an inadequate annual Social Security COLA to be resolved anytime soon, experts say. That makes it all the more important to include a longer-term inflation hedge in your financial strategy. Your best bet, says Mike Lynch, Managing Director of Applied Insights at Hartford Funds, is to maintain a healthy dose of equities in your investment mix, along with fixed income investments such as bonds and certificates of deposit. Stocks historically have delivered the best inflation-beating returns over long periods, he says, compared with other assets. Other investment options that can help you hedge against cost increases include inflation-protected annuities, which provide an income stream that's guaranteed to keep pace with rising prices, as well as Treasury inflation-protected securities, or TIPS, which adjust their rates twice a year to reflect changes in the consumer price index. Having a mix of assets is key. Quote, "We need to make sure we stay well diversified," close quote, Lynch says. Quote, "It's proven that over time a diversified portfolio will really help keep up with and hopefully outpace inflation," close quote. Moving along in Kiplinger's, are you prepared to live longer? A new measure of longevity readiness indicates that for many Americans the answer is no, and suggests what is needed to get on track. This was written by Richard Eisenberg. MIT Age Lab and the John Hancock Life Insurance Company recently partnered to create the Longevity Preparedness Index. What does the index measure, and what are you hoping to learn from it? Answer. The index asks Americans, are you aware of what you need to do to prepare for a longer life? Have you assessed where you are now, and have you taken any action to be ready in the future? To get a read, we asked over 1,300 people questions about their social connections, finances, daily activities, care options, home, community, health, and life transitions, and evaluated each domain on a scale of 0 to 100 to get a baseline of how prepared we are. Question. You found that most Americans are underprepared for longer lives. You give them a D. What are we doing wrong? Answer. It's not so much that we're getting it wrong, but we're hacking longevity because we have no precedent. We are living longer but don't think about the practical aspects, where we're going to live, how we're going to get around. The point of the index is not to give people a grade, but to give them a heads up. We're hoping it sparks a movement toward awareness and action. Question. Very few people you surveyed knew who is going to care for them as they age and how they'll afford care. It was the biggest blind spot. Why? Answer. We are terrible about projecting our future selves. While we might be able to see the need for care coming, we don't want to admit to it. We haven't had conversations with our spouses about care to put a plan in place. Question. What is the connection between financial readiness and longevity preparedness? Answer. As you might expect, we found the better off you are financially, generally speaking, the more prepared you are for a longer life, but not in all cases. Many of us did not anticipate our lifespan outrunning our wealth span. We're having a wealth of time and a dearth of resources, as evidenced by rising poverty rates among older Americans. Question. The index shows that women are generally more prepared for longevity than men. Why? Answer. Women typically are the primary caregiver. They are the chief consumer of the house. They make the healthcare decisions. As a result of their roles over a lifetime, they realize that having a robust investment portfolio does not predict a robust retirement. Question. What are the most important steps we can take to better prepare for our longer lives? Answer. The first thing is to ask yourself, Is your home age-ready for you to stay there? We should rethink simple things such as, can we get to the front door? Is it 3 steps up? 10 steps up? Your 50s and 60s might be a good time not just to remodel, but to think about whether your cabinets can be lower and whether the bed is low enough to get in and out of without falling. After that, the most important thing to do is to have the care conversation. Talk to your spouse or partner. Talk to adult children, if you have them. If you don't have those people, start thinking about your social network of close friends you can depend on. Question: were there any findings that surprised you? Answer: I don't think people are fully aware they need to continue to invest in their social portfolio, their social connections, as much as they invest in their retirement portfolio. Question: what are the benefits of people becoming better prepared to live longer? Answer: anticipating what is to come will probably incentivize us to be far better financially prepared. Longevity preparedness also means you might be able to remain independent longer. That takes the burden off your children and your spouse. Ultimately, longevity preparedness improves society in general. It's about keeping people engaged and productive. That can reduce chronic disease costs down the road. The question is, how much quality of life can we have now that we have a longer life? Next up, premium rewards cards. More perks, higher fees. Some issuers are hiking the annual fee on their flagship luxury credit cards by hundreds of dollars. Are they still worth using? This was written by Sean Jackson. If you have a premium credit card, you may be paying significantly more for the privilege. The annual fee for Chase Sapphire Reserve is rising to $795, a $245 increase from the previous fee of $550, while American Express is boosting the annual fee for its Platinum card to $895, a $200 jump from the former $695 fee. Along with pushing up fees, the cards are revamping their benefits. In addition to other long-standing perks, Chase Sapphire Reserve cardholders now get semi-annual credits of $250 for bookings with hotels and resorts that are part of the edit. Chase's curated collection of fine hotels and resorts. $150 in semi-annual credits at restaurants that participate in Chase's exclusive tables program. $150 in semi-annual credits for concert and event tickets through StubHub and Viagogo. $10 monthly for a Peloton membership, and $10 monthly for Lyft rides. You also get a complimentary subscription to Apple TV Plus and Apple Music worth $250 annually. New benefits for Amex Platinum cardholders include an increased semi-annual credit of $300 for stays at properties in Amex's fine hotels plus resorts or hotel collection, $100 quarterly in credits for purchases at restaurants that participate with the Reezy platform, $25 monthly in credits for an expanded list of digital entertainment subscriptions, including Paramount Plus and YouTube TV, $75 quarterly in credits for purchases at fitness apparel stores Lululemon, and a $200 credit annually for an Oura Ring, a fitness tracking device. Whether you already have a premium card or are thinking about opening one, the key consideration is whether you get enough value from the benefits to make the annual fee worthwhile. Think about which perks fit into your current lifestyle. If you travel often, access to airport lounges and credits toward hotel stays or flight incidental fees may easily cover the annual fee and more. Those who already subscribe to streaming platforms or other services that a card offers as a complimentary perk may come out ahead. If you have to stretch beyond your typical spending to use the benefits, however, think twice about whether the card should be in your wallet. Quote, do the math on your circumstances. Did you save money or did you go out of your way to use perks to justify the fees? Close quote, says Ted Rossman, senior industry analyst at Bankrate. Quote, you could just be treating your card as an expensive coupon book, close quote. And don't overlook changes that may be less favorable for you. Under Chase Sapphire Reserve's previous structure, for example, you could exchange points earned with the card for all bookings through Chase Travel at a value of 1.5 cents each. But going forward, points are generally worth 1 cent apiece for Chase Travel redemption. Chase has instead introduced Points Boost, in which points are worth up to 2 cents each only on select hotel and flight purchases through Chase Travel. If you're on the fence about whether you're getting adequate value from your premium card, you could try asking the issuer to reduce the fee for a year. If your issuer won't provide a discount, consider switching to one of its other cards with a lower annual fee. Here's a brief sidebar: helping young people get going on saving. When longtime personal finance journalist Jonathan Clements, creator of the popular Wall Street Journal column Getting Going, received a terminal cancer diagnosis at age 61, his friends asked how they could honor him, perhaps a journalism award in his name. "No, too many awards already," he said. Instead, he wanted to help young people get going financially, just as he had throughout his career. And so the Jonathan Clements Getting Going on Savings initiative was born. The program aims to help young adults, especially from low-income households, become lifelong savers by educating them about Roth IRAs, helping them open accounts, and for a random sample, providing $1,000 in seed money. Researchers based at MIT will follow the participants selected from a Boston Youth Employment Program to learn whether this type of program is effective in helping young people get into the savings habit. More than $400,000 has been raised so far. The columnist passed away in September of 2025, but lived long enough to learn that the first few grants had been dispersed. Quote, "We don't know yet if we can turn young people into lifetime investors, but we hope so," close quote, says Clement's friend Jason Zweig, a Wall Street Journal columnist. Quote, "As Jonathan told me last year, I won't be around to find out whether it works, but you will," close quote. Moving forward in Kiplinger's, information about the markets and your money. Get a handle on the soaring cost of owning a car. Car ownership has gotten a lot more expensive. From January 2020 to August 2025, ownership costs surged by 41%, according to an index from Navy Federal Credit Union. That compares with a 25% climb in overall consumer prices over the same period, based on the Consumer Price Index. Steep increases in auto insurance premiums following the COVID-19 pandemic have been a major contributor. Costs for auto repairs have swelled too, up 15% year over year in August, according to CPI data. Tariffs of 25% on imported car parts are driving up repair costs, as are more complex repairs for vehicles packed with advanced technology, such as sensors that assist with blind spot monitoring or warn you when you drift out of your lane. After a crash, fixing damage to these systems can add up to 37.6% to repair costs, according to AAA. To mitigate ballooning car ownership expenses, try making these moves. Consider ownership costs when you choose a car. As you decide which model to buy, think beyond the purchase price. Picking a vehicle with solid fuel economy rather than a gas guzzler could save you hundreds of dollars a year. You can select vehicle models and compare their fuel economy. Reliability ratings of car brands can help you determine the likelihood of a car needing frequent repairs. In its most recent assessment of vehicle dependability, which tracked problems in the first 3 years of car ownership, J.D. Power found that Lexus rated highest overall. Among mass market brands, Buick, Mazda, and Toyota topped the rankings. With online calculators, you can assess a car's overall ownership costs. Kelley Blue Book, a vehicle evaluation and research company, offers a tool that lets you do a side-by-side comparison of 5-year costs for various models. $11,577 is the average annual cost of owning and operating a new vehicle, according to AAA. If you haven't compared quotes on auto insurance policies in a while, it's worth shopping around. Take advantage of any discounts you qualify for, such as for automatic bill payments or low annual mileage. Stay on top of routine maintenance, such as oil changes and brake inspections, to help avoid costly repairs down the road. You may spend less at an independent garage or oil change shop than at the dealership, according to Edmunds, although certain tasks, such as work on sophisticated electronic systems, are best performed at the dealer. Look for coupons or specials that offer discounts on maintenance services. Next up, we're still bullish on stocks, but now is the time for investors to pull in their horns and dial down risk. This was written by Ann Kate Smith. The U.S. stock market set 36 all-time highs in 2025 through October, remarkable for an aging bull that entered its fourth year that month. The S&P 500 index returned 17.5% over that period, 21.5% in the 12 months since we published our 2025 investing outlook, and a cumulative 91% since the bull market began in October 2022. So why do some investors feel like there's a piano tied with a fraying rope suspended above their heads? The risks they're worried about include sticky inflation and a weakening job market, continuing trade tensions and potential cracks in the credit markets. Above all, investors are leery of an artificial intelligence boom that brings to mind bubbles of markets past. Are these concerns just proverbial bricks in the wall of worry that bull markets like to climb? Or are they signposts of something more sinister? We think the bull market will remain intact and deliver further gains to investors in 2026, driven by a resilient economy, lower interest rates, and decent corporate earnings growth. Stock market strategists that we track see the S&P 500 closing out 2026 at a price level between roughly 7,200 and 7,750. We'll ballpark it conservatively near the midpoint at somewhere around 7,500. That's up from a close of 6840 on October 31st, the date for prices and returns in this story, implying a price gain of more than 9%. Add in dividends for a total return of just under 11%, call it low double digits. Quote, "We've had 3 straight years of double-digit returns," close quote, says Shannon Sakocha, chief investment officer in the wealth management division of Neuberger Berman. Quote, "The absolute return might be more modest in 2026, but we remain constructive," close quote. Of course, the year will present a number of challenges, including an adjustment to a new Federal Reserve chair in the spring and midterm elections in the fall. But the biggest fear in the hearts of investors is that the market surge we're seeing now will stop short and head south. At the risk of mixing too many metaphors, it might be helpful to think of the market this way. There may well be a distant storm brewing, but for now, we're issuing a storm watch, not a storm warning, and the clouds could either dissipate or darken from here. That means it's not time to evacuate the market, but it makes sense to batten down the hatches by making sure your portfolio is built soundly and able to withstand whatever comes. Before a government shutdown turned off the data spigot, it was clear that the labor market was softening. Intensified immigration restrictions have constrained the supply of workers, pressuring job growth. Economists also theorize that companies may be slow to hire as they assess the potential for AI to help them reduce headcount. For various reasons, a growing number of companies have recently announced layoffs. Among them, UPS said it cut 48,000 jobs in 2025. Amazon.com said it was targeting 14,000 jobs. Kiplinger expects the unemployment rate to peak at 4.7% in mid-2026, then settle back to 4.5% by year-end, equal to year-end 2025. Quote, "Hiring has slowed quite a bit, and those unemployed are unemployed for longer," close quote, says Matthew Martin, a senior U.S. economist at Oxford Economics. Quote, "If you're a new entrant to the labor force or you've been laid off, finding a job is really hard," close quote. Meanwhile, inflation is stuck at a rate of 3% above the Federal Reserve's 2% target as tariffs work their way through the economy. The government's September inflation report showed price gains in 3/4 of all goods categories, up from 2/3 in August. Historically, the level has been less than half. Quote, "You see the impact of tariffs in goods inflation," close quote, says economist and market strategist Ed Yardeni. Quote, "We'd have been at 2% inflation if it wasn't for the tariffs," close quote, he adds. Kiplinger expects that after closing out 2025 at 3.0%, the inflation rate for consumer prices will settle back to 2.6% by year-end 2026. A currently bifurcated economy poses risks on both sides, considering that consumers account for roughly 2/3 of the economy. With lower-income households struggling, economists worry about decelerating spending and the potential for rising delinquencies. But even with high-end consumers providing the lion's share of support, there's a risk that because so much of that household wealth has been accumulated in a sizzling stock market, a sharp correction could cause the cohort to cut back on spending, making the correction more hurtful for the economy than might otherwise have been the case. Recent cracks in the credit markets made headlines when a handful of bad loans linked to fraud allegations dinged some regional banks, and called into question the opaque risks at the so-called shadow lenders in the burgeoning private credit sector. J.P. Morgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon compared these soured loans to cockroaches. Quote, "When you see one cockroach, there are probably more," close quote, he said. For now, most market watchers are characterizing the problems as idiosyncratic, meaning isolated instances of fraud, and see no infestation. But as bankers comb through their ledgers for potential trouble spots, some are sure to appear. Quote, "Bear in mind that delinquencies within the credit market broadly are very low. We'll see an increase from below normal delinquencies to normal levels as the cycle matures," close quote, says David Lefkowitz, head of U.S. equities at UBS Global Wealth Management. Quote, "That could be a headwind for regional banks. Our investment preference is for money center banks, but we don't think this is going to metastasize into something more troubling," close quote. It's not particularly comforting that Savita Subramanian, head of equity and quantitative strategy for Bank of America Global Research, found similar sentiments when she reviewed commentary from the 2007 market peak prior to the global financial crisis. Back then, there was, quote, "cautiousness but optimism overall," close quote, she says, quote, "with some mentioning that risks are small and not likely to bleed into financial markets," close quote. Looking at the U.S. stock market broadly, there's no getting around the fact that valuations are stretched. The S&P 500 benchmark trades at a price-earnings ratio based on estimated earnings of 23. That's above the 5-year average of just under 20 and the 10-year average of 18.6. And Bank of America analysts are seeing an increase in bear market warning signs. 6 of 10 bear market indicators have already triggered warnings. On average, 70% are triggered just before market peaks. 2 that appeared in September indicate a sense of complacency on the part of investors and an increased appetite for speculation, says Subramanian. Investment bubbles are a thankfully rare but occasional fact of investing life, starting with the 17th century's tulip bulb mania. Comparisons of today's AI-obsessed market with the internet-driven dot-com bubble of the late 1990s are proliferating. When that bubble burst in the spring of 2000, a nearly 50% bear market and recession ensued. Bank of America reports that stock prices today eclipse March 2000 levels on 9 of 20 valuation metrics, including the market value of the S&P 500 in relation to gross domestic product, average price-to-book value ratio, average price-to-operating cash flow ratio, and the market's median price-earnings ratio. A record 54% of fund managers surveyed by Bank of America say that AI stocks are in a bubble. Quote, "Investors have been chasing mega cap tech. They can't afford not to be in it. But at some point that will end, and I think that period is potentially closer than further out," close quote, says Bank of America's Subramanian. The massive numbers that define the AI boom specifically are mind-boggling and therefore have invited some skepticism about whether sufficient AI-related revenue will materialize soon enough to justify them. The companies investing the most in AI, they're dubbed AI hyperscalers and include cloud computing giants such as Amazon.com, Microsoft, and Alphabet's Google, have cumulatively increased capital expenditures from $153 billion in 2023 to an estimated $390 billion in 2025, according to Goldman Sachs analysts, accounting for 27% of CapEx for companies in the S&P 500. Capital expenditures include spending on long-term assets such as property, equipment, and technology. In this case, think AI infrastructure such as chips, power, and data centers. Estimates of 20% growth in AI CapEx in 2026 are too low, according to Goldman. Without AI CapEx, business spending in the U.S. economy overall would be quote-unquote weak, says Martin at Oxford Economics. Although AI adoption rates are, quote, "still quite low," close quote, overall, he says, they are growing, with usage rates in some sectors, such as finance and technology, much higher. Ultimately, corporate America will have to realize significant AI-generated productivity gains to support the high levels of capital spending, says Martin. Quote, "It's very hard to forecast the magnitude of AI and the timing. We continue to highlight the risk, but it's not something we're penciling in for the near term," close quote. Results for the most recent quarter, however, provided a window into how investors can turn on a stock when they perceive a misalignment between AI spending and its potential payoff. After Meta Platforms vowed to spend quote-unquote aggressively on AI, raising its forecast for 2025 capital spending to as much as $72 billion, and signaling even more for 2026, the stock sank more than 11% the next trading day. Given so much to worry about, why are we still bullish on stocks? Because a more nuanced look at the potential perils diffuses them somewhat. Although investors should certainly expect pullbacks in a market that has soared nearly 40% just since April, we'd rather make some portfolio adjustments to accommodate the growing risks than throw in the towel now. Quote, as in almost any year, you'll see some pullbacks, some news that makes people nervous. Close quote, says Keith Lerner, Chief Investment Officer and Chief Market Strategist at Trust Wealth. Quote, but pullbacks are the admission price for being in the market. Close quote. Jeffrey Schultz, Head of Economic and Marketing Strategy at Clearbridge Investments, an asset management firm, agrees. Quote, we're buyers of dips because we see the market continuing to move higher. Close quote. Starting with the economy, the combination of fiscal stimulus for both consumers and businesses provided by the recent enacted tax and spending bill, together with lower interest rates courtesy of the Federal Reserve, provides a bullish backdrop, typically seen only coming out of recessions, says Schultz. Much of the stimulus will come in the form of individual tax refunds. Quote, that will help support low and middle-income consumers in 2026, leading to a more uniform consumption picture. Close quote, he says. Quote, it's a reason to be optimistic on the consumer and the economy overall. Close quote. Still, Kiplinger expects only modest to moderate economic growth in 2026 as tariffs, federal workforce cuts, and canceled contracts with government contractors, nonprofits, and universities work their way through the economy. GDP growth should come in for the year at just under 2%, relatively unchanged from the 1.8% growth rate expected for 2025. Meanwhile, there's nothing the market loves more than a Fed rate cut, especially when it arrives with no associated recession. At the end of October, traders expected the Fed to cut its benchmark target rate a quarter percentage point to 3.5% to 3.75% in December, and were expecting two more quarter point cuts in 2026. In this case, there can be too much of a good thing, and the Fed will have to find a balance between disappointing the market by cutting rates less than expected and cutting too much. Something to watch as the new regime takes shape at the central bank in May. Quote, we're not concerned about a slowdown or recession, close quote, says Charles Tan, Chief Investment Officer of Global Fixed Income at fund company American Century. Quote, we're more concerned about the Fed overeasing and the economy overheating, close quote. Cutting rates too much could reignite inflation. It could also destabilize the stock market by injecting stimulus it doesn't need, says economist Yardeni, causing what he terms a market quote-unquote melt-up. Yardeni, among Wall Street's staunchest bulls, sees the S&P 500 ending 2025 at 7,000 and 2026 at 7,700. Quote, those targets should be expected sooner in a melt-up, forcing us to raise our odds of a bearish outcome, a correction, bear market, or meltdown, close quote. In October, Yardeni raised his odds of a melt-up to 30%. He sees 50% odds of a healthier bull market and 20% odds of a bear. Corporate profits drive the stock market, and for the most part, they're accelerating. At the end of October, in the midst of third-quarter earnings season, 83% of S&P 500 companies that had reported by then had logged earnings that exceeded analyst expectations. 12% reported results below expectations, according to earnings tracker LSEG IBES. In a typical quarter, 67% of firms beat estimates and 20% miss. In aggregate, reported profits were 8.3% above expectations, compared with a long-term average of 4.3%. Overall, Wall Street analysts were expecting year-over-year earnings growth for S&P companies of 11.6% in 2025 and 14.1% in 2026. The tech sector still leads with the highest expected earnings growth in 2026 at 23%, followed by materials and industrials, with expected growth in profits of 21% and 19%, respectively, year over year. Quote, with the Fed cutting in a large fiscal package, the broadening of earnings that was supposed to materialize in 2025 is a greater possibility in 2026, close quote, says Schultz. Quote, but it's a show-me story for now, close quote. Though fears of a bubble are widely discussed, many of the market watchers we talk to think boom might be a better descriptor, at least for today. Quote, down the road, I think there is a substantial probability that we will see a bubble at some point, followed by a potentially gut-wrenching correction, close quote, writes Chris Buchbinder, an equity portfolio manager at Capital Group, in a recent note. Quote, but I don't think we're there yet, close quote. For now, says the bullish Yardeni, quote, the only thing we have to fear is too much fear about bubbles, close quote. Consider some of the quality markers that differentiate today's market from the dot-com bubble, for example, beyond the fact that today's market leaders, in contrast to their late 90s counterparts, boast robust profits. In addition, free cash flow yield, free cash flow divided by stock price, for the median large company stock was recently almost triple what it was in 2000, according to Morgan Stanley chief strategist Michael Wilson. When adjusted for profit margins, the S&P 500 trades at a 40% discount to its price-earnings multiple back then. Quote, free cash flow generation, operational efficiency, and strong profitability are all characteristics of a higher quality index than what we saw during the late 1990s, close quote, Wilson says. Bank of America analysts note that the S&P 500 companies today have lower financial leverage than their turn-of-the-century counterparts, and the index has a higher percentage of companies with quality ratings of B+ or better. Moreover, according to Goldman Sachs, the AI infrastructure spending boom has yet to reach the profligate levels of previous innovation cycles. Quote, we are not concerned about the total amount of AI investment, close quote, analysts wrote in a recent note. As a share of U.S. GDP, AI investment today is less than 1%, they note. During the electrification of manufacturing in the 1920s and the internet boom of the late 1990s, spending peaked at around 1.5% to 2% of GDP and reached well over 3% with the build-out of railroads in the 1880s. It's worth noting that mini bubbles are inflating and deflating in other corners of the market, with few ill effects overall, says Liz Ann Saunders, chief investment strategist at Charles Schwab. Quote, I think there is a lot of speculative fervor in the market, but the good news, with quotes around good, is that recently the froth is more evident outside the mega cap leadership names, close quote. Quantum computing names, drone companies, meme stocks, micro caps, tech stocks with no profits, and recently gold are all examples. Quote, you can see some air come out of those bubbles without it causing major damage to the market, close quote, says Saunders. Of course, major bubbles are only recognized in hindsight after they burst. Let's say we're in one right now. Bubbles can inflate for years, and being out of the market while they do is costly. The S&P 500 more than doubled from the time of former Fed Chair Alan Greenspan called out the market's quote-unquote irrational exuberance in late 1996 until it crashed in early 2000. Quote, while I acknowledge the difficulty of assessing bubbles with foresight, I believe we are closer to 1998 than 2000, close quote, says Buchbinder, noting, for example, that we have yet to see an initial public offering boom in innovative startups such as OpenAI, the company behind ChatGPT. How will we know when the end of this phenomenal bull run is near? We won't. Back in 2001, Warren Buffett used the analogy of Cinderella at the ball to warn investors about overstaying in an overheated market. Quote, the giddy participants all planned to leave just seconds before midnight. There's a problem, though, close quote, he wrote. Quote, they are dancing in a room in which the clocks have no hands, close quote. That's why it's crucial now to make sure your portfolio allocation is in line with your tolerance for risk, from both an emotional and financial standpoint. Can you withstand a 10% to 20% correction? How about the average bear market drawdown of 38.5% or the 40% plus average loss in what CFRA chief investment strategist James Sam Stovall calls a quote-unquote mega meltdown? If the thought of any of that makes you uncomfortable, it's time to de-risk a bit. That doesn't mean dumping the winners that have fattened your portfolio over the past few years, but it does mean making sure they haven't taken over your holdings. Good investing habits, including staying diversified and rebalancing your portfolio by periodically trimming winners and buying laggards, are more important than ever. Consider that the information technology sector currently accounts for 36% of the S&P 500. At the individual stock level, the top 10 stocks in the index, led by NVIDIA, Apple, Microsoft, and Amazon, account for 40%. Although strategists at many investment firms continue to favor the technology sector, those at Wells Fargo Investment Institute recently recommended that investors trim holdings, downgrading the sector from quote-unquote favorable to quote-unquote neutral due to its rich valuations. They advised investors to shift some funds into utilities, industrials, and financials. It may also pay off in 2026 to venture beyond large company stocks generally. Quote, a little bit down cap offers a lot of opportunity, close quote, says Kara Murphy, Chief Investment Officer at Kestra Investment Management. Smaller large company stocks and mid-sized stocks look interesting, she says. And now let's move on to Fortune magazine. How DoorDash won the delivery wars. Inside Tony Zhu's battle to master the last 100 feet. By Jason Del Rey. The delivery guy's legs were propelling him toward the parked car I was in at a pace that registered somewhere between, quote, I'm training for my neighborhood 5K, close quote, and, quote, grab the key, start the ignition, let's bail, close quote. The scene might have posed some cause for concern if not for the identity of the man barreling toward me. It was Tony Zhu, co-founder and CEO of DoorDash, the $85 billion delivery company that has experienced a meteoric rise over the past 5 years. But on this mild fall day in downtown San Francisco, Zhu was not playing the role of Fortune 500 CEO. Instead, he was spending the afternoon as a dasher for DoorDash, zooming around San Francisco in a staffer's white Audi SUV. His own car was cluttered with his kids' car seats, he told me, to deliver fried chicken salads and Mediterranean bowls. It wasn't his first time. As a co-founder of the company, he was one of the company's first dashers, and all U.S. salaried employees must do 4 delivery shifts a year. At one point, he pulled a mid-street U-turn that impressed even this New York City native. A short while earlier, Zhu had accepted 4 orders from the same ghost kitchen, industry vernacular for a takeout-only restaurant. Quote, this is what I call playing the game on extra-hard mode, close quote, Zhu said. Quote, I've never done a quadruple batch, close quote. Now, Zhu wanted to demonstrate a feature on the DoorDash app's interface for dashers. Quote, the order's not ready yet, but look, I want to show you something cool, close quote. Zhu told me as he neared the Audi, which he had parked in a questionably legal spot on a narrow two-way street in San Francisco's Soma neighborhood. Quote, you see that? It just popped up like 10 seconds ago, close quote. Zhu thrust his iPhone toward my face to read the alert. Quote, would you like to unassign from the order, close quote? I was a bit stumped. Quote, because it knows the order's going to be extra late and knows our first 2 orders are at risk, close quote, Zhu explained excitedly. Quote, so it doesn't want to punish me. In the interest of time, I'm going to say, yes, unassign me, close quote. This algorithmically determined triage is just the kind of hyper-focused approach that Zhu has built his company on. Sounding now like a geeked-out startup entrepreneur, Zhu rattled off other seemingly tiny operational improvements that DoorDash has rolled out, including desserts being highlighted for dashers because they are most likely to be forgotten. He showed me how DoorDash's mapping technology built in-house advises dashers on everything from the best location to park near a customer's door to the specific entrance they should use in large corporate or residential buildings. These are details that might save only minutes or seconds on a delivery run like ours, but company leaders believe that together they add up to the key difference between success and failure in the most intensely fought battle in the on-demand economy, the delivery app war. Quote, with all of this data, we are trying to build the catalog for the physical world, close quote, Zhu told me. quote, this repository of information does not exist on Google Maps. It doesn't exist on ChatGPT. We are compiling it all for the first time, close quote. Amazon, UPS, FedEx, and even the U.S. Postal Service may make different claims to mastering the quote-unquote last mile of delivering physical products or parcels, but DoorDash is striving to go a layer deeper. It wants to, in Zhu's words, quote, master the last 100 feet, close quote. If it can, the business opportunities will feel endless. 12 years after its founding, DoorDash has separated itself from the pack in the U.S. restaurant delivery industry, on track to generate more than $13 billion in annual revenue in 2025 while owning around 60% market share, more than double the size of its nearest competitor, Uber Eats. Grubhub, which along with its subsidiary Seamless once dominated the third-party restaurant delivery business in the U.S., now stands a distant third with less than 10% market share. That trajectory should serve as a cautionary tale for DoorDash, though. No lead is safe in food delivery. DoorDash is pursuing expansions, both in new retail categories as well as geographies, that could prove prescient or disastrously distracting. An economic downturn or crash could also be an existential risk if cash-strapped customers give up the convenience of food delivery with its fees and meal markups, and DoorDash could, of course, be displaced by a competitor like Uber or an AI-native company that may not yet even exist. There's plenty of risk, but also a huge opportunity. If the company's meticulous strategy continues to be effective, and if it can stay ahead of its competitors, it's possible that the company's current market cap will soon seem ridiculously small. Quote, delivery happened to be where we got started, close quote, Zhu told me, quote, but for a restaurant or retailer, our aspiration is to be your first phone call for any business issue, close quote. Among Zhu's admirers is Mark Zuckerberg. The CEO of Meta told Fortune that Zhu, who serves as a director on Meta's board, has been a quote-unquote great advisor who has modeled an approach to business success antithetical to that of many Silicon Valley entrepreneurs. Quote, there's a lot of people in the Valley who talk about big ideas that in the abstract seems appealing, but in practice have all these nuances that don't quite work out, close quote, he said, adding that Zhu is more quote-unquote realistic. Indeed, the key to success, Zhu believes, is detail-obsessed forward motion. Quote, if you're in technology and you are not making improvements, you are actually decaying, close quote, the CEO told me. Quote, until it's over all of a sudden, close quote. The possibility of doom has rarely been far from Zhu's perception since he and three fellow Stanford students came up with the idea for DoorDash in 2012. A year later, they launched it into the growing race for delivery app dominance, plunging into a gutted-out battle among startups that would feature near-death experiences, whiplashing morale, cutthroat business decisions, and investor blindsides en route to a hard-won victory. Indeed, DoorDash almost crashed before making it off the ground. Zhu now enjoys telling the story of the Stanford football game that made and then promptly broke the new startup in the fall of 2013. Overwhelmed with orders from student fans, Zhu and his then tiny team delivered every meal late, some dramatically so. The right thing to do was to refund every customer, but those refunds would cost the startup 40% of its bank account, leaving them with less than $30,000. They did it anyway, and then stayed up all night to bake cookies that they handed out to the customers the next day as an added mea culpa. It's hard to know exactly how many customers would have returned without the "we're sorry" sweets, but the move cemented what the founders say was a core value of the startup, customer obsession. If the incident had been the startup's death knell, no one outside of Palo Alto would have noticed. DoorDash already had plenty of competition. There were young enterprises, including Postmates and Caviar, that went on to become established brands. Others, such as Munchery, Spoon Rocket, Maple, and Sprig, tried to differentiate by making and delivering their own in-house meals rather than acting as a middleman for existing restaurants. They all failed. And there was one 800-pound gorilla in the sector already. Grubhub and Seamless had merged earlier that same year. Chicago-based Grubhub was by then almost a decade old, and New York City's Seamless was a few years older than that. but Grubhub and Seamless were just ordering platforms and worked only with restaurants that employed their own delivery people. Zhu and his co-founders saw things differently. The rise of smartphones had allowed for so-called gig workers to accept and complete orders in basically real time. Companies like TaskRabbit, Uber, and Instacart had proven this model out. They saw that by creating a network of contract delivery people who worked on demand, not only would the company avoid the overhead costs of full-time staff, but it also would drastically expand the number of restaurants that could offer delivery even if they didn't employ their own delivery staff. DoorDash began listing menus on its app, even for restaurants that hadn't signed up as partners. To make it work, DoorDash delivery workers would place the customer's order themselves, often paying with a DoorDash-funded debit card. Since the company wasn't getting a cut of the sale, it would sometimes pay itself by marking up the restaurant's prices in addition to charging customers a delivery fee. Others used the same delivery model with variations. One, another Bay Area startup, Postmates, had built a network of gig workers willing to fetch just about anything from any store. Its meal delivery component had started to take off. Then came Uber. In 2015, the Travis Kalanick-led startup launched the dedicated Uber Eats app in Toronto to immediate explosive growth. At the time, the company was only a few years old, but already doing about $1 billion in gross sales from its core ride-hailing business. Within 3 years, Eats was in 42 countries. Along the way, Uber reached as much as 33% market share for meal delivery in the U.S. at a time when DoorDash was only about half as big. At the time, DoorDash looked unlikely to catch up. The narrative in Silicon Valley around DoorDash was that its cash-burning ways were killing the company and its promise in the eyes of investors. With each new market that the company launched, DoorDash would spend heavily on marketing, advertisements, steep discounts for first-time customers, and hiring on-the-ground staff to sign up merchants and couriers. Within the company, morale was flagging, Zhu told Fortune. Quote, I would show this graph of our bank account going like this, close quote, he recalled, pointing his fingers downward. He told his staff he wouldn't blame them if they wanted to look for work elsewhere. Some took him up on it. The situation got so bad that Sequoia Capital's Alfred Lin, who had led the company's Series A investment round, had to persuade his own partners to lead the Series C round in 2016. To get it done, DoorDash had to accept a lower valuation than the one accompanying its previous round of fundraising. Quote, we were less than a month from running out of money, close quote, Lin told Fortune. In Silicon Valley, the word was essentially that DoorDash was on death's door. Uber, for one, was basking in its rival's troubles. Quote, I was feeling pretty good, close quote, a former Uber leader told Fortune. But 2017 had other plans for Uber. The high-flying startup underwent a cultural implosion following accusations of rampant sexual harassment and a brutally toxic culture, leading to the resignation of Kalanick and the hire of the well-respected but more financially conservative Dara Khosrowshahi, who had the unenviable task of cleaning up the company's image as well as its balance sheet to prepare it for a not-too-far-off IPO. As a result, Uber Eats, which was burning around $500 million a year to fuel growth, according to the former company leader, was instructed to cut its win-at-all-cost spending. The desire to rehabilitate Uber's image also meant the Eats team couldn't engage in one of DoorDash's more controversial practices, listing restaurant menus on its app without a restaurant's permission. While such a move was often a hit with diners, it also created ill will with some restaurants that were peeved by the inflated prices DoorDash sometimes charged to offset the lack of commission fees from the restaurants, as well as a loss of control over their customers' experience and frequent confusion during pickup at the front of their stores. The burger chain In-N-Out even sued DoorDash for such practices in 2015. The case was quickly settled out of court, and DoorDash stopped delivering from the burger chain. Eventually, some cities moved to outlaw the practice of adding restaurants without their permission, and DoorDash didn't fight it, having already profited for many years from its first-mover advantage. This caused some resentment. Quote, DoorDash did it, got escape velocity, and then pulled the ladder up on everyone else, close quote, said another delivery industry entrepreneur. As Uber Eats was taking its foot off the gas in marketing spend to acquire new customers, DoorDash smelled blood. The company ramped up its marketing and poached several key executives between late 2018 and early 2019 from Uber Eats, in part by offering lucrative pay packages. Adding insult to injury, the funding for DoorDash's spending blitz came from an investor quite familiar to Uber leaders. SoftBank, the Japanese funding giant, was the largest Uber backer at the time. SoftBank led what would become a king-making $535 million round for DoorDash in March 2018. Some Uber leaders were miffed that a key minority shareholder of theirs was funding one of their rivals. Quote, we were like, WTF, close quote, the former Uber leader said. SoftBank did not respond to requests for comment. In any case, DoorDash was off to the races, expanding from around 1,500 cities and towns in North America at the start of 2018 to around 6,000 by the end of 2019. Competitors jeered at this dizzying expansion as a cash incineration machine. But Zoo and team were swinging for the fences, continuing to prioritize suburbs and mid-tier metro areas that their rivals had neglected. They viewed these geographies as green fields that would reap bountiful harvests with the right attention and financial nurturing, and the company's analysis of customer data showed that new markets would turn profitable in time thanks to strong retention. Listening to Zoo recently share his long-term vision for DoorDash has Zuckerberg convinced, he told Fortune, that we'll eventually consider the DoorDash CEO, quote, one of the great business leaders of our time, close quote. Quote, it wasn't about lofty ideals or silver bullet strategies that are going to solve everything at once, close quote, Zuckerberg said of Zoo's roadmap for DoorDash. Quote, it was about very methodical, gritty, competitive approaches, close quote. It's not always going to go smoothly, as my hour of delivering DoorDash meals alongside Zoo on that early fall day showed. We were able to deliver only two of our four orders on time, and we had to leave one behind altogether, to be delivered late by another Dasher. At the end of the hour or so it took to complete the three other orders, the CEO had earned $19, including tips, which would likely be topped up by the company to comply with minimum pay and mileage requirements in California's app-based delivery driver law, but is still not a stellar sum considering the cost of living in the Bay Area. If we had delivered all four orders, Zhu said, quote, we would have probably easily cleared $25. I think a Dasher would have been pretty happy about that. I would have been personally happy with that, close quote. You've been listening to Down to Business. My name's Greg Conroy. This has been brought to you by the good folks at Mind's Eye Organization, helping the low vision and blind communities in the St. Louis region since 1973. Have a great week. Take care.